Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, Saving Capitalism, For the Many, Not the Few, today's guest, economist Robert Reich, writes, if democracy worked as it should, elected officials, agency heads, and judges will be making the rules roughly in accordance with the values of most citizens. But if democracy is failing or never functions to begin with, the rules might instead enhance the wealth of a comparative few at the top while keeping almost everyone else relatively poor. Breaking down the five building blocks of capitalism, Robert Reich illustrates how large corporations and the wealthy have effectively rewritten the rules. Doing so under the guise of protecting free market capitalism, they have amassed even more capital, market control, shaped contracts and bankruptcy laws to serve their needs, and they've weakened accountability and enforcement mechanisms. As a result of all of this and the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street, the middle class continues to shrink. According to Robert Reich's research, CEO pay has climbed 937% between 1979 and 2013. 937%. The pay of a typical worker over that time rose just 10%. Robert Reich joins us to talk about modern capitalism and how or if the system can be saved. Robert Reich is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economics. He served in three national administrations and has written 14 books, including the bestsellers Super Capitalism and Locked in the Cabinet. And he'll be talking about saving capitalism tonight in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church at 7:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Robert Reich. Welcome back to the show.
Well, hello, Rose. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for joining us.
Delighted.
So we already got a few emails saying that capitalism is not the answer. So before we dive in, why don't you define today's capitalism?
Well, it's hard to find a country that is not capitalistic in the sense of basically relying on private property and the voluntary exchange of goods and services. Even communist China, so-called communist, is pretty capitalist these days. Also, Denmark, Sweden, the Nordic countries that we sort of associate with socialism are basically capitalist countries. So I think in some ways, the title of my book, Saving Capitalism, is a little misleading. Because certainly capitalism of some sort is going to be the prevailing system. The real question is who it's for, who benefits. Is it for all of us or is it for a few? I just returned from 3 weeks in the Midwest, mostly red cities, red states, so-called Republican. I asked my publisher if I could go to places I don't normally go on book tours, and they said fine. And interestingly, most of those people I talked with did not like the title. They said, Saving Capitalism sounds like you're finding fault with capitalism. And of course, I came back to the West Coast and people say, Saving Capitalism, why would you want to do that? So it's a title that doesn't work for anybody.
Well, I love that you wanted to talk with conservative Republicans and Tea Partiers, because I find that when you get past the sound bites and, you know, the Rush Limbaugh sound bites, a lot of people actually have the same views. I mean, if you look at the polling, 75% of the country opposes Citizens United. The majority of the country believes in a minimum wage increase, Social Security caps being raised. I mean, on and on and on. So what did you find in these conversations?
Well, most people out there who describe themselves as conservative Republicans or even Tea Partiers did not like what they called crony capitalism. And when I asked them what that was, they often said, well, subsidies and tax breaks going to particular corporations or industries because they have a lot of political clout. Corporate welfare. They hated the idea of corporate welfare. They don't like big money in politics. They think one of the first things we need to do is get big money out of politics. They did not favor, most of them I talked with, again, mostly conservatives. People call themselves Tea Partiers, conservative Republicans. They didn't want the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They thought executive pay, CEO pay was an abomination, what's happened to it, and average workers. So if you took away the labels,
yep,
a lot of these people sound an awful lot like populists on the left, except with regard to the social and cultural issues. There, they are miles apart.
Right. Okay, so when you're talking about saving the system, I mean, you've got a whole set of policy changes that you'd like to see. You write about how we got here. But what is your main argument here? What do you want to save exactly?
Well, what we need to do is make sure that the system is designed as it was for 30 years after the Second World War. We don't have to go back to the same system, but it was designed for the purpose of expanding prosperity, building a middle class, creating avenues of upward mobility for the poor into the middle class, and not bestowing most of its gains on the very, very wealthy. And what's happened over the last 30 years, Rose, is that not only have globalization and technological change really made it very difficult for people without much education to do better and provided huge gains for those who have all the right education and the right connections, but something else has gone on, and this is what I focus on in the book, that there's a kind of vicious cycle that as money, wealth, income go to the top, so does political power. Even before that shameful Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. And as political power goes to the top, the power to rig the rules of the game, the actual rules of the market, the fundamentals. This is not about just taxes and transfer payments. This is about the meaning of property, the meaning, how we define contracts that are enforceable, bankruptcy, the things that we take for granted about what antitrust ought to be all about. All of these ways in which the basic building blocks of capitalism have been shifted so that they benefit people at the top, don't really benefit most of us. And that, in turn, is a vicious cycle because it means the people at the top have more and more political power to further rig the rules of the game.
How do you begin to deal with that? Because a really interesting study came out of Princeton last year that looked at where the people stand on issues like Social Security, healthcare, the environment, and 9 times out of 10, they found that people were in favor of like a minimum wage increase or, you know, saving Social Security, for example, lifting the cap. And then they looked at how politicians actually legislate those issues. And they found that politicians do the exact opposite of what the people want. And it's because of money and politics. And, you know, Princeton is, these researchers basically said this is not a democracy because there's so much money in politics. So if you have an institution like Princeton saying that, how do you begin to unravel that?
Well, it's very much what the great Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said in the 1920s when he said, we can either have great wealth in the hands of a few or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. And I think the Princeton researchers you're referring to found that when you have, as we do now, huge amounts of wealth and income in the hands of a few that that call the political shots because of their campaign contributions, their lobbying, their influence politically, the voices of most Americans are not heard. How do you get out of that? Well, in the book, I refer to countervailing power, populist and reformist upsurges that occurred in this country at least 4 times before when you had similar periods of time in which capitalism seemed to be working for a few, not for the majority, because the few had control over the rules of the game. It was in the 1830s, and again, the populist upsurge in the 1890s that led to the progressive era between 1901 and 1916. And then again, of course, the 1930s, the New Deal, and to a lesser extent, but not unimportant, was the 1960s, in which the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, all of it, again, put our system, our political economic system, back on track to be a system that rewarded and provided for equal opportunity to a much greater extent and widened the circle of prosperity. In other words, Rose, we have inside the American system, and it's very much disguised right now, but if you and I were having the discussion right now that we're having in the year 1900, we might feel as we do now. It's almost hopeless. But we have in the American system a capacity to roll up our sleeves, get on with reforming and changing the system through these upsurges of discontent. And I think that right now, if you look at American politics and ask yourself, well, where did Bernie Sanders come from? Where did, in a very different tradition, but nevertheless a populist tradition, Donald Trump come from? And I'm almost embarrassed to use the same, to put the two men in the same sentence, but they represent different traditions of populism in which essentially the anger and frustration that is welling up finds expression in a determination to remove the ruling class and substitute something quite different.
I'm speaking with Robert Reich about his new book, Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. Since you brought up Bernie Sanders, I saw a new poll yesterday by McClatchy and Marist, and it found that Bernie Sanders wins in a landslide against both Donald Trump and Jeb Bush.
Well, I'm not surprised in a way. Somebody called me this morning who is a Bernie Sanders supporter, very disconsolate, upset because another poll showed that Hillary Clinton is pulling away from Bernie Sanders and doing very, very well. And I checked make sure my memory was correct, and it was, that in November of 2007, that is at exactly the same point in time before the last general presidential election without an incumbent, Hillary Clinton was in front of Barack Obama by almost exactly the same amount that she is now in front of Bernie Sanders. So anything can happen politically.
Anything can happen.
At least at this point in time. There's still a long way to go.
If people get out and actually take part in the process. Now, you also write that we got here for many, many reasons, but it's about so much more than globalization. I mean, that plays a huge factor, of course, but you also say that it's really important to look at how CEO pay is determined, intellectual property rights, and antitrust laws. You say that those are also other factors that we need to spend more time on and really learn about.
Yes, there's an ideological framing of the great debate between liberals and conservatives, people on the right and left, that I think is fundamentally wrong. And that framing posits a choice between the free market on the one hand and government on the other. And I can't tell you how many times I've been in public debates with people calling themselves conservative Republicans or conservative economists or political economists who say within almost 4 or 5 minutes of the debate starting, regardless of what we are talking about, it doesn't make any difference. They frame the debate as if the choice is free market. Do you trust the free market or do you trust government? Do you trust the free market to do the right thing or do you trust government to do the right thing? And in this book, my new book, I've tried to show that that frame of the debate has no relevance to what is really going on. You can't have a free market without government setting the rules of that market. There's no free market in nature. You know, in nature, it's just purely survival of the biggest and most powerful. At least in a market, you have an opportunity to create a civilization in which people do have more of an equal opportunity to get ahead. Government has got to define the elements of the market, has got to define property. You know, right now, the most important form of property we have is called intellectual property, patents and trademarks. And there's been a major change over the last 30 years in how long those patents and those trademarks remain in effect, whether, for example, pharmaceutical companies can pay off generic manufacturers of pharmaceuticals not to introduce their generic versions until way after the patent has been exhausted, thereby keeping the patent in effect much, much longer. In all of these ways, the game has been, even with regard to what is the meaning of property, has been rigged more and more in favor of big corporations and also in favor of Wall Street.
Well, let's talk about this since you brought up the drug companies, because you've got some really good stories in your book about how drug companies have been able to persuade politicians to write rules that favor them. So they spend hundreds of millions every year in lobbying. These are the pharmaceutical companies. In 2013, their lobbying tab came to $225 million, which was much more more than the lobbying expenditures of military contractors. And you write that an estimated 50 million Americans, more than a quarter of them with chronic diseases, did not fill their prescriptions in 2012 because they couldn't afford them. Drug companies pay the makers of generic drugs to delay their cheaper versions. And these so-called pay-for-delay agreements, perfectly legal, generate huge profits for both costing Americans an estimated $3.5 billion a year. We do not see this happening in Europe, for example.
That's right. And it's not just the pay-for-delay agreements that are perfectly legal here and illegal in most other countries, but all sorts of ways in which the pharmaceutical manufacturers, through their lobbying prowess and their political contributions, have changed the rules to make drug prices higher. I mean, you can't get your drugs from another country. You know, only a few years ago, you could order drugs from Canada. You can't do that any longer in the United States. 15 years ago, it was illegal for prescription proprietary drug manufacturers, that is, drug manufacturers whose drugs you could only get by prescription from a doctor, to advertise their drugs. Because what was the point of advertising if you could only get the prescriptions through a doctor whose judgment had to be made? Well, the drug companies lobbied, and they got a change to that because they knew that if they could advertise to people, those people would say to their doctors, I want that particular drug, even if it's going to be more expensive. I believe that advertising and marketing has been so powerful and so important to the pharmaceutical industry, and we're paying for all of that, Rose. That means that Americans are paying more for the pharmaceuticals we buy than any other citizens of any other industrialized country. The same is true across the board. If you look at internet service providers, we are paying more for internet service and having slower internet service than almost any citizens of any other advanced country. And the reason is similar. It's lobbying. It's political power. The cable companies have spent huge amounts of money to solidify their monopolies, both at the federal level, at the state and local levels as well. And you go through step by step, industry by industry, and you see the amount of money that is being spent by large American industries, by certain big companies to entrench themselves. And you see the result of all of that is a redistribution upward from most of us, hidden inside the market, to these big companies, their major executives, their major shareholders. And that hidden redistribution upward is almost never talked about.
Well, and this continues whether there's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, because President Obama just chose Dr. Robert Califf to lead the Food and Drug Administration. And Senator Bernie Sanders, who sits on the Senate's Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee, says he's not suitable to lead the FDA. He called him a pharmaceutical industry loyalist. This man received $200,000 in consulting fees from pharmaceutical companies between 2009 and early 2015. But this is the kind of thing that just doesn't get much play in the media. I mean, it might get a couple of headlines, but, you know, you're not hearing about it in the national news. And this just happened. I mean, Obama just announced this in September. So you also write about the revolving door.
It doesn't. I mean, we all know about the revolving door between industry and government. We all know, or at least many of us know, that doctors are getting payoffs essentially from drug companies. That should be illegal. It used to be illegal. It's illegal in most countries. And yet they're getting payoffs. Why? Because the drug companies think that that's going to help them in terms of doctors making prescriptions and basically suggesting to patients that their drugs are going to be helpful. This is a conflict of interest. I think the one reason that the media don't report on it is they don't connect the dots. They don't see that what happens in one industry and in one sector of the economy is directly related to what's happening all over the economy, and that this amounts to, as I said a moment ago, a redistribution upward from the incomes of average working people upward to the top 1% with regard to executives, top 1/10 of 1%, 1/100 of a percent, and also major shareholders. The media also depend on advertising. Some of the media, I hate to say this, but some of the media, particularly the mainstream media, they don't want to antagonize their advertisers.
And they're making a lot of money during the presidential election. Today we're speaking with Robert Reich, author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. If you have a question for Robert Reich, if you'd like to weigh in on how, you know, what policy prescriptions should be implemented to change course? Do you think the system can be saved with the right policy changes? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, you know, since we're talking about the fact that so much of these issues are getting worse under a Democratic president. I mean, cities are now across the country. You've got Seattle, Los Angeles, and the state of Hawaii have announced a state of emergency over homelessness. And so the Democrats are really no different than Republicans on a lot of these issues. And Bernie in Noe Valley writes, if Robert Reich really wanted to make a more economically just America, he would start by reforming his own party or work toward making a legit third party. With all due respect, Harvard-educated elites within the Democratic Party claiming to feel our pain while betraying America's blue-collar class with the likes of NAFTA and the TPP.
Well, Bernie has a good point. I mean, I think the Democrats don't have that much better a track record than Republicans, although, honestly, if you look at the legislation and you look at the votes of the Democrats in Congress versus the Republicans in Congress, there is a difference. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. One reason that Obama didn't accomplish quite as much as many of us had hoped is because he faced the most unified, recalcitrant Republican Congress in recent memory, or perhaps certainly over the last 100 years. But I think Bernie's point is right in the sense that a populist movement, such as we are beginning to see across the country, that unites left and right, that is angry about what has happened, that is determined to take back our economy and our democracy for the vast majority rather than for an elite that is becoming divorced from the rest of society, seceding from the rest of society, is almost inevitable if we continue in this direction.
Well, and what are your thoughts about Hillary Clinton's very close ties to Wall Street? Top donors, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, a lot of the banks. In 2013, Hillary Clinton made $3 million in speaking fees from Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and UBS. And now she's basically, because Bernie Sanders is talking about free higher education and taxing the rich, health care for all, Hillary Clinton is now, she has kind of a populist tone. And Politico ran an article recently saying, yes, Wall Street executives understand that she has to talk like this, but they know that she's not going to implement these policies if she becomes president.
I think it's a huge problem, Rose. It's a problem for her politically, but more importantly, it's a problem if, in fact, Wall Street has the kind of influence, assuming she's elected president, in a Hillary Clinton administration that it's had in a Bill Clinton administration. I mean, I can't tell you how frustrating it was to be sitting in meetings, cabinet meetings and other meetings in the Clinton White House, in which the Wall Street crowd, the Wall Street representatives embodied in the Treasury Secretary and Undersecretary and many of the Wall Streeters who found their way into the Clinton administration basically towed the Wall Street line, did not want to regulate derivatives, for example, wanted to get rid of the Glass-Steagall Act that separated investment from commercial banking. After I left the administration, ultimately Bill Clinton went along with them and did repeal Glass-Steagall, and consistently argued for trade opening agreements and for the kinds of cutbacks in investments in education and infrastructure that we needed to have. We didn't.
And hold that thought, Robert Reich. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Robert Reich about his new book, Saving Capitalism, For the Many, Not the Few. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation with Rose's guest, Robert Reich, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you would prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, and then at noon today from our friends at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. It's Bina.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the elections in Myanmar. We'll also talk about a new Vice News investigation about the rise of the national security state and close ties between universities and the military. Next week, we're putting shows together about renter protections and rent control laws, also transportation. We're talking about all of the new housing that's needed in the Bay Area. Well, what about better transportation? And also, we're going to talk about mental health and suicide prevention. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Robert Reich. He's out with a new book, Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. He believes that in the coming years, the divide in the United States will not be between Democrats and Republicans. It will be between large corporations, Wall Street, and the very rich. He believes with the right policy changes and grassroots organizing, capitalism can work for most of us rather than just for the 1%. So what do you think? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we have full lines. Let's go to Michael and El Cerrito. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, given the amount of power that the 0.001% has in government, and given that it's apparent that a constitutional amendment would be needed to get that money out of the political system, and given that the big money would spend a lot to prevent that amendment from happening, how do you see the for the first time in history that this could happen without some kind of a revolution?
Well, Michael, remember McCain-Feingold, which wasn't perfect. The McCain-Feingold Act that the Supreme Court overruled in its awful Citizens United decision, that was a limit and initially quite strict limits on campaign contributions. It was enacted. Many people said it couldn't be done, but there was enough of a popular upsurge and enough even some companies said we don't want to be shaken down by lobbyists to have to make campaign contributions. And so we have had periodically in this country, we've had campaign limits put into effect, and they have worked for a time. I think we can do it again. Citizens United, though, does have to be reversed. It has to be reversed either by constitutional amendment. That's going to be hard, very difficult to do. Or it's going to be reversed. Remember, it's a 5-4 decision. The five Republican members of the court were in favor. The four Democratic appointees were not. The next president, and I don't generally support litmus tests for Supreme Court justices, but I think the next president does have to have a litmus test, and that litmus test is I'm going to only appoint a justice that is absolutely committed to reversing Citizens United.
And would you agree that the next president will almost definitely appoint one justice, maybe two?
Well, I that seems likely because you've got so many justices who are over the age of 70, a number who are approaching 80 or over. So just in terms of actuarial predictions, you would think that the next president would be appointing at least one.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for calling in, Michael. Let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I certainly have not given up on working on the national front in terms of political things. I want to be going to leaflet in front of the supermarket for Bernie Sanders as soon as I get off the phone. But I would appreciate Professor Reich's opinion about whether, since it appears that the public have greater control on issues that are dealt with on a local basis, things like the usage of pesticides, minimum wage, living wage, even smoking regulations, and on a state level, air pollution from automobiles, whether it would not be desirable in terms of giving the public greater control of our society to devolve certain powers from the federal government to state and local governments.
William, that's already been happening. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that devolution you're talking about has already been happening to a remarkable extent. I mean, the minimum wage is basically all the action is now at the state and local level. That's why we have in Seattle and Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York, with regard to fast food workers, now a $15 an hour minimum wage, and most of the rest of the country is still stuck with a minimum wage much lower, and some with a federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. But here's the paradox and the problem, because states' rights, or the devolution of responsibility to the states, is also and has also historically been used by the right as a way of burying issues of state white majorities overruling the goals and needs of minorities. So you've got to be very, very careful about devolution. We don't want devolution to mean, for example, what Paul Ryan would like to happen to Medicare, or Medicaid, rather. That is a block grant to the states, in which Paul Ryan knows very well that once you block grant Medicaid to the states are going to use that money for not for the poor and not for minorities who are also poor. They're going to use that money for other things.
Robert Reich, what were your thoughts on President Obama's spokesman, Robert Gibbs, taking a major communications job with McDonald's?
Well, I don't like it, Rose. I mean, I don't want to blame anybody personally, and I'm not going to in any way denigrate Gibbs. But every time you have people in the White House or in Congress or in cabinet positions leaving those positions and then working for in major positions on Wall Street or in private industry, you're creating the impression in the public's mind, and maybe it's an accurate impression, that you have pulled your punches while in office, that you are part of the revolving door problem. This is an aspect of crony capitalism. People in office who are preparing themselves for lucrative jobs outside, once they get outside government, and therefore not being as vigilant as they need to be. I think it's a bigger problem with regard to the revolving door between the Treasury Department and certain high levels of an administration and Wall Street, and also in Congress. You know, I have a little bit of historic perspective on this, because when I first went to work in 1967 for Robert F. Kennedy as an intern in Robert Kennedy's Senate office, at that time 6% of retiring members of Congress went to work as lobbyists. Now, more than half of all retiring members of Congress go to work and get very good lucrative jobs as lobbyists. Well, that revolving door is nobody really talks about. It's just as, I think, serious a problem, both in terms of its appearance of kind of conflict of interest, but its actual effect on many members of Congress in terms of pulling their punches and not being as strong and as courageous as they might otherwise be in the public's interest.
In your chapter about monopolies, you write that Comcast is one of Washington's biggest revolving doors. Of its 126 lobbyists in 2014, 104 had worked in government before joining Comcast. Former FCC member Meredith Atwell Baker, for example, went to work for Comcast just 4 months after voting to approve Comcast's bid for NBC Universal in 2011.
Yes, and you see that becoming more and more the case. But, Rose, let me just back up a bit, if you permit me, and just say that there's a lot wrong, and we can and the first part of my book I catalog and try to put into perspective and connect the dots around all the things that are going wrong with regard to money in politics, the distortion of power, the connection between power and wealth, and the distortion of our democracy. But what I want to emphasize is that this is not inevitable, that we can get big money out of politics. Historically, we have done it before. There are signs around the country that a populist movement is growing. I think the choice before us in coming years is not going to be between either left or right, Democratic and Republican, as it's normally defined. The real choice is between what kind of populist we want to support, either a right-wing populist, such as Donald Trump, essentially saying, I'm a strong enough, you know, I'm just a strong man, and I just follow me, and I'll get it done. And by the way, your problems are related to them, kind of a scapegoating that is so often associated with right-wing populism, or left-wing populism that says essentially we're going to fundamentally reform our democracy, we're going to reclaim our democracy for our people. I think Bernie Sanders is the exemplar of that movement. But regardless of what happens in 2016, that is still growing. It started in recent years with the Occupy movement, and I think it will continue to grow as a very important kind of political movement in the United States.
But no major Democrat has come out in favor of Bernie Sanders yet.
No, and I think that is to Bernie Sanders' credit, because if he had a lot of members of Congress and a lot of senators saying, oh, yes, I'm with Bernie Sanders, that would take away from Bernie Sanders' essential message, which that he's not the establishment. Hmm. He's not business as usual.
Robert Reich is author of the new book, Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, and he'll be speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley at 7:30. Find information at yourcallradio.org, and if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Tim in Alameda. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. If I understand Dr. Reich correctly, by saving capitalism, he means the top 1% corporate power in America is ruining the economy. Lives of the average people are a disaster because of the top income level. So redistributing income is part of the solution. However, I wanted to ask if China is also an example of capitalism today. Isn't the way capitalism produces wealth the real question, the real essential question, which is to extract the most amount of labor with the least amount of pay, the cheap labor backed up by a police state in the interest of corporate power? How do we save capitalism then?
Well, Tim, I think, first of all, let me get to your first point, which is that the major way to make it work is through redistribution. What I try to argue in the book is that there is now so much upward redistribution hidden inside the market that if we got rid of that, if we actually had a market that was working for all of us instead of a few at the top, we wouldn't need as much redistribution downward in order to have a system that worked. With regard to your second point, China and the necessity of a police state in order to extract wealth, we know that there are examples of capitalism and capitalist systems that are working for the majority and are widening the circle of prosperity. Closest to home, we have the example of the United States between 1946 and 1980, in which as the economy expanded, as productivity improved, even those in the bottom 20% of the income distribution saw their income almost double during those years, even faster than people at the top 20% of the income distribution. We were on our way to a more egalitarian society. Granted, we had a lot of work to do with regard to African Americans and women and other minorities, but we tried to do it. I mean, that was what the civil rights movement was about and the voting rights movement, the war on poverty. We are capable, in other words, of creating rules of the game that are working in favor of most people. There's nothing inherent in capitalism. I think this is where I disagree with Karl Marx. There's nothing inherent in capitalism that means that we are going to be essentially always battling this kind of class warfare. What happens is that when we as citizens take our eye off the ball, when we view citizenship as nothing more than a spectator sport, when we see our responsibilities as nothing greater than voting and showing up for juries and paying taxes, and forget that an essential part of citizenship is vigilance and activism and engagement, that's when things get off track.
Thank you for calling in. Let's go to our next caller, Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, I'm in Sausalito. Okay. We see the military-industrial complex has come to pass, just like Eisenhower foretold. And it was interesting to hear Carl Lewis on NPR the other day when they asked him about ISIS. He said, that's Halliburton's problem. They started the war. It went in Fallujah, at least. And then we have corporate presidents like Cheney and Rumsfeld, who knew about the weapons of mass destruction because Rumsfeld sold the chemicals that he knew about to Saddam Hussein when he was president of the American Chemical Company. So you see that these companies have become intertwined so closely with government that it's not capitalism at all. It's militarism.
Well, Robert, let me, quite apart from the label you want to sign, I mean, it is certainly militarism, but I think that what we are seeing, and this is increasing over the last 30 years, is a kind of corporate capitalism, a capitalism that is so infused with and dependent on the money of big corporations and a few very, very wealthy people, many of them associated with Wall Street and Wall Street itself, that it is no longer really the capitalism that we had in the first three decades after the Second World War, nor is it the capitalism we had between 1901 and 1916, the so-called progressive era, nor is it the capitalism that Franklin D. Roosevelt was very much in the process of reforming between 1933 and 1938, let's say. I think 38 is probably the end of the New Deal. As far as real effectiveness of that New Deal. Undoubtedly, military contractors are almost unassailable congressionally. They have insinuated themselves into almost every congressional district in America. The military is the biggest jobs program we have in America, and so that they have entrenched their positions of power. There's very little review. Every time a conservative Republican talks about a bloated federal budget, I want to say, well, look at the military. That's where you have the most bloat. That's where you have the most expenditure that is unreviewed and unquestioned.
Well, and again, this hardly gets attention. Just on Tuesday, the Senate approved a final defense authorization bill, $607 billion. It approved spending for 63 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, six more than the Pentagon requested, nearly 20 more than were authorized in 2015. The bill authorizes $1.4 billion in R&D funding for a replacement submarine. There's a great story that I just found over at the Hartford Courant. But I mean, this barely got any attention, and this just passed on Tuesday.
It gets very, very little attention, Rose. And the, you know, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, we know that they are obsolete. I mean, they've had tremendous problems in production. We're spending huge amounts. If we took even half of what we were spending on the F-35 Joint Strike Fighters and put it into programs for education for the needy, for better schools for the poor, for even school lunches and food stamps, we would be doing so much more good.
And it was a 91-3 vote. 91-3.
Yes, and that reflects exactly what I was just saying, that what the military and military contractors have been so clever at doing is creating the largest jobs program in America and making sure that it was spread over almost every congressional district. So you have Democrats as well as Republicans voting in favor of these bills. Now, but again, the background question here is can we take back our economy and our democracy? Are we just almost inevitably fated to have an economy and a democracy that are run by large companies and Wall Street and military contractors. And my point is no, that is not necessary. If you look at history, you find that at certain historical points, we have reasserted, we being the people, have reasserted ourselves. We've organized and mobilized. You know, I kind of divide the people I talk with out in America, including the people on this book tour. But, you know, I spend a lot of time when I'm not on book tour talking to people around the country into two categories. One are the whiners, people who come up to me in airports. I don't even know them, but they come up. You know, I'm a stranger to them, but they feel like we've been in some sort of a conversation over the years, and they say to me, "Well, what are we going to do? Or can you believe how bad it is?" And they just complain, and I ask them, "Well, what are you doing about it? What are you actually doing every day? Are you an engaged citizen?" And they look at me, kind of as if I've asked them. You know, are you on Mars? I mean, they don't even know what I'm saying. But the activists are very different from the whiners. The activists understand that it is all about mobilizing and organizing for the long term, not just for an individual election. It's about developing the infrastructure of a citizens' movement. You know, I am chair of a national organization called Common Cause, which is one such citizen movement. It has a very, very important and effective chapter here in California. Common Cause is dedicated to getting big money out of politics. And I think everybody listening ought to become a member and be an activist member of Common Cause.
Robert Reich is author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. We have time for a few more calls. Let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Oh, thank you. Excellent timing. First, I'd like to thank Mr. Reich. I'm work with the National Association of Letter Carriers, so I thank you always for your support of the Postal Service and the union associated with that. What I'd like to ask is I have been advocating for almost 20 years that, in fact, the campaign to make these changes, I believe, does have to be made locally and in local government. I think that's one of the things that the Republican Party has been able to comprehend, and they have a firm grip on local government, state government, and based on that, from that power source, they're also able to move not the presidential election but congressional elections. And if the third party were to be created, which I think is going to really be essential, it needs to concentrate and focus on the areas where they're strongest in the local, and then from that base expand to other local governments, state governments, and then from that base start placing congressional representatives both in the Senate and in the Congress, and from that base they can look perhaps towards a presidential placement. Now, I know it's going to take time because we started late, but I don't really see another option.
Well, I think, Robert, it's a good point. I mean, with the proviso that I and possible concern I raised before in this broadcast about states' rights movements being sometimes anti-democratic and also intended to kind of submerge the votes of minorities, there's no doubt that we've got to work on the local and the state levels. The Koch brothers have been very effective at supporting quite regressive movements in state and local governments. I was spending some time recently both in North Carolina and in Wisconsin, and many of the people of those states don't know what's hit them. They say that suddenly our government is no longer a government of the people as we understood it. We were reformist, and now we seem to be taken over by, I don't know, people who are very different and have a fundamentally different agenda. Well, in both of those states, the Koch brothers have spent a lot of money, and the Koch brothers' allies have spent a great deal of money. So we can't let our eyes off the ball with regard to state and also local governments, nor can we stay in our bubbles. Many people, particularly in places like blue states like California, and Massachusetts, where I'm from originally, and New York, we talk to people who agree with us. We listen to the media that basically confirms our assumptions. I tell my students it is vitally important. The only way to learn anything is to talk to people who disagree with you. Get out of your bubble. And you'll find, as I did on, just the last 3 weeks on book tour in Red America, that there are a lot of people out there who, particularly with regard to the economic themes and the power themes that we've been talking about this hour, are in complete unity, complete agreement. It's not really left-right any longer. It's really a matter of anti-establishment versus establishment.
Right.
And the question is how to win those people over.
Last question, Robert Reich. Michael Moore's new documentary, Who to Invade Next, he basically invades other countries and brings back their good ideas to the United States. And when you're looking at the policy prescriptions that you would like in place, is there another country that you use as an example?
Well, I think Bernie Sanders is correct that there are a lot of things going on in Northern Europe, not just in Denmark and in Norway and Sweden, but also in Germany with regard to co-determination, how workers in Germany really have much more of a voice in the management of big corporations that we can use here. The difficulty, however, Rose, is that that overlooks what I've said a couple of times on this broadcast, that we here in the United States also have a legacy that we should be proud of, we should go back to. When you tell American voters, well, we need to be more like Denmark or like more like another country, they scratch their heads and say, well, but we're not. We're Americans. We're different. And therefore, I think it's important to say to Americans, we have had periods in this country when we have widened the circle of prosperity, we have reformed ourselves, we've reclaimed our democracy, and we can do it again.
And so many of those ideas actually came from the United States.
They certainly did. I mean, fighting Bob La Follette from Wisconsin in the 1890s and early 1900s was probably the most important progressive voice we have had, ironically, from Wisconsin, whose ideas shaped the progressive era of Teddy Roosevelt, and also found very much effect in the New Deal.
Robert Reich is author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. He is speaking tonight in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church at 7:30. Robert Reich, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rose.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the elections in Myanmar, where opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy is about to secure a landslide victory. We'll also talk about the Vice News investigation, about the rise of the national security state, and close ties between universities and the military. What grabbed your attention in the news this week? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.